I'm turning now to 2nd Book of Samuel, chapter 15 and verse 10. 2nd Samuel chapter 15, verse 10. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron." Our subject is God orchestrates deliverance, and we're considering lessons in faith from the life of David. Going back just for a moment to the beginning of chapter 15, it came to pass, Absalom returns to the capital, but it came to pass that he prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. And the fickle people, unfortunately, were deeply impressed by his performance and his activity. And then we read of how he would rise up early in the second verse and take up a position as if a judge in the nation. And the nobles and the rich would bring him their cases and their causes, and he would tell them that David had failed to appoint anyone to hear them, and say, "Oh, if I were king, then I would do this and do that." It was his manifesto. And so the hearts of the people of Israel were stolen. Verse 6, "And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel." And then this is just quickly by way of introduction from verse 7, how Absalom went to David and he pretended to him that he'd vowed a religious vow. Absalom? Vowing a religious vow? The wayward Absalom? But he had such charm about him, and he was so sincere in his pretension, and he put it to David that he had made this vow, and he wanted to go and complete it, and he would spend his life from now on in the service of the Lord. David could scarcely believe it, but though he was the shrewdest of men, he chose to believe it, because he had this almost inordinate affection for Absalom, for all his faults. And so David was swayed. "Absalom has been converted," you can almost hear him thinking. "Absalom has been mightily changed by the Spirit of God. He now wishes to be a dedicated man." And he allowed him to carry on. He gave him great liberty, allowed him to proceed as he wished. But all along, Absalom, of course, was planning his great rebellion. And that brings us to verse 10. "But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of a trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron." What an amazing thing. Whoever heard of a coup by proclamation? A bloodless coup, perhaps. A clue by PR tactics. Carried out a coup by fraud. But that's what this amounts to. Absalom sent spies. Spies perhaps isn't a very good word. Representatives would be a better word. They were noblemen, and they weren't privy to Absalom's plan and plot, probably dreamed up by Counselor Ahithophel, but that's speculation. They weren't aware of what was going on. These were people who would be respected, and they would go out to the provinces and to the towns and carry the message. "There's going to be a new king," they would say. "Well, why would there be a new king? Well, David is old, you know." He was over 60 by this time. Over 60 in those days is rather like being over 80 today. David is old. What's going to happen? Well, he will either stand aside, this is my assumption, he will abdicate. He's been very sick. We know he had been very sick because the Psalms written at about this period all speak of David's wasting disease and his terrible sickness and his struggles with health. They're the Psalms of the period. So he was a sick man, and he very well likely was missing out on appointing judges to represent him in the seat of judgment. There were grounds for complaint against David, but people should have borne with that because he'd been such a marvelous king for them. And he'd given them security and prosperity, and he'd upheld the religion of the land and stood behind the Lord in all these things. But as soon as he begins to fail in certain respects, then they don't want him. They want the young, glamorous Absalom. And so this coup by proclamation, these innocent nobles are sent out to say, when you hear the trumpet sound and the beacons are lit and all the usual signs of a great change in the land, then take up the cry and start the celebrations. Don't you see? Sound the trumpet, get this thing underway, have everybody celebrating, it'll be unstoppable. A coup by PR techniques, almost entirely. Absalom reigneth in Hebron, and it will show the great desire of the people for this. And they would be ready to be taken in. Because after all, Absalom, he was a man of such stature and charm, and they wanted a king they could be proud of in a very carnal, physical sense. And besides which, David was a moralist, and the people at large will always prefer a liberal over a moralist. And Absalom was an extreme liberal, and Absalom was irreligious, and David was pious. So you see, all these things added together, and the people would swing quickly behind Absalom. Verse 11, and with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called. Look, they were innocent of his particular plot, and they went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything. What a plot. All the agents that are going to make it happen don't actually realize this is a gigantic fraud. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, David's friend, David's counselor. But Ahithophel was a very cunning man. David never entirely realized what he was made of. And in all probability, he'd already given Absalom this advice. But you can't be certain of that. But he got Ahithophel, David's counselor, from his city, even from Gilo. And the conspiracy was strong, and the people increased continually without through the work of these nobles, innocenting the untruth that there was going to be a new king. And verse 13, and there came a messenger to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom. Unfortunately, it was sound intelligence. And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, and his own limited bodyguard, arise, let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. He realizes now Absalom is unchanged. He's been tricked. Be hurry to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city. David acted for the preservation of the people of the city, for the preservation of the religious centers, and so on. And he was going to abandon the city at once. He got loyalty, verse 15, from his small band and his servants, but it wasn't much. And in verse 16, the king went forth, and all his household after him, and he left 10 women, which were concubines. He certainly shouldn't have had them, but he did have them, and he left them to keep the house, the palace, in his possession. I can't imagine what the reasoning behind that was. It was presumably, well, if there's any shred of decency, they won't turn my supplementary wives out of the palace, and they'll be preserved, and the palace. But Absalom could sink a lot lower than that, as we shall see. And verse 17, the king went forth, and all the people after him, and they went to a place that was far off. And then you find in verse 18 that the people who were with him, the small numbers of troops that he had for him, actually all foreign mercenaries. They're all foreigners. No loyal citizens. And they pledged themselves to him. And the king is amazed. In verse 19, he asks one, why, you've only just arrived here with your small force of mercenaries to be with us in this place. There's going to be fighting and war and death and bloodshed. Go home. Make your way. But no, even a foreign mercenary pledges himself to David. And he uses Jewish language to do it. He seems to be a convert, a man of faith. And so David accepts him. But in verse 23, all the country, well, it wasn't all the country, most of the country was with Absalom. What is clearly meant here is all the country immediately round about David, Jerusalem and its suburbs, the people around. The others were with Absalom. And all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people passed over. The king also himself, and they went over the way of the wilderness. But verse 24, they had Zadok and all the Levites with him. They took the Ark of the Covenant, Zadok and the Levites, and Abiathar also was with them. That's in verse 24. And David in verse 25, he says to the priestly party, take the ark back into the city. We can't have it with us. It belongs there in the holy place. Take it back to the city. And then, well, you may ask, if it isn't a silly question, was David a Calvinist? Well, of course, such terms are known. But look at verse 25. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me again and show me both it, the ark, and his house, his habitation. So David now, the best of David is coming out. He's summoned his faith and is reacting to this as a model child of God. You can't bring the ark with you. Return it. We're in the hands of God. If he wills and if he hears us, we shall return to this place. And his trust is greatly increased. And verse 26 consolidates that tremendous attitude. But then in verse 27, King David goes further and he says to the priestly party, you go back home, go back to Jerusalem and be my eyes. And you've got sons who are very fleet of foot, tremendous runners. And they can run messages to where I am, saying what's going on and what Absalom plans to do. And that's what those verses that follow cover. But verse 30, David went up by the ascent of Mount Olivet and wept as he went up and had his head covered, and he went barefoot. This is a significant verse. And all the people that were with him covered every man his head, and they went up weeping as they went up. Well, that'll tell you easily what that is about. David knows that this trouble within his family and the rebellion of Absalom he has brought upon himself. Nathan the prophet gave him previously a message from God. God would forgive him, God would bless his reign and preserve his life, but there would be a penalty to pay for his conduct, for his adultery and for other misdeeds, and there would be trouble in his family and great heartache. And now it's come. Well, at least it hasn't just come. Something has happened before, but this is much more serious. And David's first thought is, what may I have done to bring this about? And there's a pastoral lesson for all of us. Some unexpected misfortune happens in the life of the Christian. We're always ready to ask, how did I get into this? What have I done? What foolish step? What wrong action? Where did I take a wrong turning that wasn't in trust and prayer and obedience to the Lord? Because David is repentant. He enters into the mode of repentance and all the people with him, and he knows this is his fault ultimately, and yet God will help him and deliver him. But he's brought the troubles upon himself. Serious sin always has consequences, even though we may be forgiven. But now verse 31, and one told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David goes to prayer. Lord, I pray thee, this is a great prayer, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. He prays. Well, Absalom seems to be gaining everything, but not quite everything. David is prayerful. Turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. And the prayer begins to be answered at once. So it is for us. When we pray to God for deliverance, if we only knew it, very often the answer is coming immediately. Verse 32, it came to pass that when David was come to the top of the mount where he worshipped God, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat rent and earth upon his head. So Hushai, he's David's other intimate friend and chief counselor. Ahithophel was one. Hushai was the other. But Hushai comes now so sad at the abandonment of Jerusalem on David's side. Well, that's an immediate relief to have a man of such wisdom. But David says to him, verse 33, if thou passest on with me, then thou shalt be a burden unto me. Doesn't sound very kind. If you stay with me, you'll be a weight around my neck. But it's true, because Hushai, for all his wisdom, was not needed by David as a soldier. David was himself the greatest of generals. He had all the strategies in his mind. He was so experienced and had had such victory over the enemies of Israel. So yes, to have another captain in the ship wasn't necessary. Another head counselor. Where I need you, he said to Hushai, is back in Jerusalem. Go back there. Be Absalom's counselor. Help bring the counsel of Ahithophel to nothing. So he prayed, but he did take sensible precautions. And he invited Hushai to undertake this difficult role, to be an agent in Jerusalem. Verse 34, but if thou return to the city and say unto Absalom, I will be thy servant, O king, as I have been thy father's servant hitherto, so will I now also be thy servant, and so on. And then David points out that he sent the priests back with their renowned runner sons, so there'll be links to him, effective communications. Verse 37, end of the chapter. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Now things are very serious indeed. Let's turn for a moment, without losing our place here, to Psalm 3. I'd just like to turn you to three psalms that relate to this very experience of David's. Psalm 3, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Here's the prayer of David recorded for us. Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter up of mine head. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone hitherto. Thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongeth unto the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people. So there is the prayer, or one of them, of David. And I turn also to Psalm 41. And we remember these things whenever we witness. Do we remember the rule? You witness, but just as important, you go to prayer. The two go hand in hand. And if not, the witness will never be effective. You try to help somebody. Yes, there's the outward help that you give, and there's the inner secret act of prayer. The two go hand in hand. That's David's practice, and we see it operating here. Psalm 41, blessed is he that considereth the poor. The poor there means the weak. The Hebrew is weak. Our translators have chosen poor. Well, that's good in context, but if you use the literal term, then you see how this applies to David. This is a psalm from the period. Blessed is he that considereth the weak. The Lord will deliver him in time of trouble. The Lord will preserve him and keep him alive, and he shall be blessed upon the earth, and thou wilt not deliver him unto the will of his enemies. The Lord will strengthen him upon the bed of languishing. Remember, David's got two problems: Absalom and his own health. Thou wilt make all his bed in his sickness. I said, Lord, be merciful to me. Heal my soul, for I have sinned against thee. He knows that the whole problem is because of his sin with Bathsheba and his murder of her husband. Mine enemies speak evil of me. That's what they were doing. The noblemen of the nation going round saying, David is weak and sick and cannot rule anymore. When shall he die and his name perish? And if he come to see me, he speaketh vanity. His heart gathereth iniquity to itself. All that hate me whisper together, verse 7. Verse 8, an evil disease, say they, cleaveth fast unto him. He's not going to get up and serve like he used to. Verse 9, is this Ahithophel? Surely this is a reference to Ahithophel. Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. But thou, O Lord, be merciful unto me, and raise me up. Verse 11, by this I know that thou favourest me, because mine enemy doth not triumph over me. The prayer of David in these circumstances. And then we could go very briefly to Psalm 55. And surely this is the same period. Verse 1, give ear to my prayer, O God. Hide not thyself from my supplication. Attend unto me and hear me. I mourn in my complaint and make a noise because of the voice of the enemy. It's his double problem. But look at verse 5. Fearfulness and trembling are come upon me. This is a tremendous threat. And horror hath overwhelmed me. And I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then would I fly away and be at rest. And down in verse 11, the psalm goes on, wickedness is in the midst thereof, deceit and guile depart not from her streets. For it was not an enemy that reproached me, then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me. Then I would have hid myself from him. But it was thou, a man, mine equal, my guide, and mine acquaintance. Surely this is Ahithophel. We took sweet counsel together and walked into the house of God in company. And the whole prayer and the remainder of it is about this situation. Verse 22, cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. He shall never suffer the righteous to be moved. Well, I go back to 2 Samuel chapter 16, and well, I was going to deal with verse 5, but let's go to verse 15 of chapter 16, the answer to David's prayer. And Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with them. This is now the time of tremendous crisis. Absalom has won. Surely he's won. He's got Ahithophel. He's got Jerusalem. He's got the house of the God. He's got, or thinks he has, the priests and the Ark of the Covenant. He's got the people, the army of Israelites. He's got the favor of the people who've turned against him and turned to Absalom. He's won. He's got everything. And yet in faith, he still takes his precautions and depends upon the Lord. Same with us, dear friends. Sometimes you could get quite worn down. You could think as a Christian, Satan has got everything. He's got the government, if you'll pardon my saying so. They all believe in the new morality, liberal morality and extremes. They all accept these things. They're all behind possible legislation which would criminalize us as Christians. Satan has the government. He has science rooting for him with signs and wonders. He has the world of education. It's now illegal in this country to teach a child anything so dreadful as creation. He's got the church, at least the established church and the visible church and the archbishop and the bishops. They're all liberal. They're all against the gospel. He's got everything. He's got the world of entertainment. What more could he want? He's got the people. He's got the intellectuals. Surely he's won. And yet from time to time in history, God demonstrates that he hasn't won. He utters his voice and the pendulum swings. Think of the Reformation. The mighty Reformation. Satan had everything. And in a few years it's broken by the Reformation. Think of revival or awakening. 1739, godless Britain. Revival sweeps through, and even the godless are having to pay lip service to religion in no time. And sometimes God has moved in a spectacular way. And one of the lesser reasons why he moves in a spectacular way is to encourage his people in leaner times. Look what I do, just at a word. And before the end shall come, those two symbolic witnesses who had seemingly been killed in the book of Revelation, representing the Church of Jesus Christ, will arise to their feet and give voice, and there'll be a mighty awakening before the last judgment. So Satan seems to have everything going his way, but it's not so. And here it is with David. All is up. Verse 16. And it came to pass, when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, was come unto Absalom, that Hushai said unto Absalom, God save the king. God save the king. In other words, you, Absalom. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this thy kindness to thy friend, King David? He was deeply suspicious of Hushai. Why wentest thou not with thy friend? And Hushai said unto Absalom, you know, throughout all this, Hushai doesn't tell a single lie. You think it's hard being an agent of David in the enemy court? Is it going to involve cunning and dishonesty? Well, actually, it doesn't. In one sense, you might say it wouldn't matter if it did, because they were at war. But anyway, Hushai said unto Absalom, nay, but the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel, whoever they choose, his will I be. What a reply. I will serve the one who the people will choose. Well, Absalom thinks that means he's going to serve him. But Hushai is speaking in faith. He believes David would ultimately get the victory and the people will swing back to him. I will serve whoever the people will choose. Here you are, democracy starts right here with Hushai. And if that doesn't impress Absalom enough, in verse 19, he gives another argument. And again, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son, as I have served in thy father's presence? He says, Absalom, should you be king? Legitimately, he implies, well, it would be right for me to serve you. If it's right for you to be king, it's right for me to serve you. I'm in the service of the king, not a particular king. Verse 20, then said Absalom to Ahithophel, give counsel among you what we should do. Well, we have to be very quick because our time really is up. But look, Ahithophel said unto Absalom, go into thy father's concubines, which he hath left to keep the house, and all Israel shall hear. What cunning! Ahithophel's looking after himself here, as well as Absalom. What a scheme! if you go and rape your father's concubines and do it very publicly, by publicly I mean they're going to put up a tent on top of the palace so that that draws attention to what's going on somehow. What's that for? That's where Absalom raped the king's concubines. It will be public in that sense. That is such an insult. That is such an offense. That is such a grave thing. Don't you see? David and Absalom could never, ever be reconciled after this. Do you see what Ahithophel is doing? He's, as it were, killing two birds with one stone. He's settling once and for all, firmly, the rebellion of Absalom, and he's making sure that things work out for him, because Absalom will never relent to his father and give him a place back in court or anything which may rebound against Ahithophel. But it's a disgusting scheme, and that's how low Absalom and Ahithophel will stoop. Verse 23, and the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. That's the esteem in which Ahithophel was held. Well, how is Hushai going to counter that? The deed is done. The rape is committed. The die is cast, as it were. And Ahithophel goes on to give his plan. It's in chapter 17. It amounts to this. He says to Absalom, let me, Ahithophel, choose 12,000 men and go in a great rush. Strike immediately, because David's reeling. He hasn't settled down. He hasn't recruited an army. He's all in pieces. Formidable as he is, if we go at once, we'll get him and kill him. And that will be the end of that. And you'll be king. It'll be a clean sweep. Well, it is a, if you pardon me saying so, it's a good scheme. It's a quick end to everything. You would think it pretty certain to work, because David's on the run and hopeless with just a few hundred foreign mercenaries around him. Verse 4, the saying pleased Absalom well and all the elders of Israel. Verse 5, then said Absalom, call now Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear likewise what he saith. How'd you like to be in his position? He's now got to give an alternative plan, which will appear to be better than that of Ahithophel, and yet will serve the cause of David more than the cause of Absalom. How's he going to do that? Verse 6, and when Hushai was come to Absalom, Absalom said, well, this is our counsel. Now what do you say? Verse 7, Hushai said unto Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel hath given is not good at this time. He's not going to go flat against it. It's not really appropriate for the present. For, saith Hushai, verse 8, thou knowest thy father and his men, that they be mighty men, and they be chafed in their minds, as a bear robbed of her whelps in the field. And thy father is a man of war, and he will not lodge with the people. Oh, says Hushai, don't underestimate David. He's like a wounded animal. He's very, very angry. And he's a great general. And he's a man of immense experience and success. He is a man of war, preeminently. And he won't just sit still and cry. Behold, verse 9, he is hid now in some pit. Don't you realize he'll already be laying an ambush he'll already have a scheme in hand. And the first people out of Jerusalem, somewhere, some unknown place, somehow, will be ambushed and killed. And that's giving them such a PR victory. Maybe they'll only kill a few hundred men, but that will go all around Israel. David is winning. And the people will swing back again. By leaping precipitately, you will hand him some completely unexpected, unforeseen victory. And you'll lose the day. No, no, says Hushai. What you must do is this. You must recruit a massive army. You must cash in on your popularity and get as many people as possible so that the enemy, David, just has no hope at all. Why use this colourful language with this vast army? We could even throw a lasso round a city and drag it to the nearest river and drown it. That's what he literally says a few verses further down. That's what you need, strength. But don't you see that what Hushai is doing is advancing a plan that's going to take an awful long time to bring about, to recruit a vast army, and David will have time to settle and prepare. We can see that clearly. But then he uses a second great temptation for Absalom, and he says, that army will be the greatest ever, and you can be at the head of it, not Ahithophel. You will get the glory. You know, there's nothing the people like more than a victorious general king. And that so appeals to Absalom's vanity. He takes the Hushai plan. What a magnificent passage it is. We read down to verse 14 of chapter 17, and Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Well, why did they say that? It wasn't a better plan, really. For the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom, because David had prostrated himself in prayer as well as taking precautions. So the Lord caused what was really the inferior plan to be accepted by the enemies of David, the overruling of the hand of God. That's all we have time for. Can't you see this in your experience, dear friends? It's not just the state of the nation, the state of the world, but you and I. Things happen in life, setbacks. Maybe it's a loved one or loved ones in the family. Turn against the Lord. And you've got a period of life which is very difficult for you. You have to walk on eggshells and pray daily. Insert testimony as and when you can. Long for a change. The battle's never lost. If you pray, you see how God can turn things round in his purpose and in his will. Maybe there are other circumstances that oppress you. We learn from this. Whatever we do has to be accompanied by earnest prayer. And if the Lord is in it, that makes all the difference. Let's close our thinking this evening.